La 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 la.
If you want to hear your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. We talk megabytes to petabytes and cover it all. They're the Gizmo Sapiens. They're the Gizmo.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens, episode 100. That's our
Woo-hoo. It's our centennial. It's also our
Christmas episode. We haven't done one in a while.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays, ooh. Whatever.
And today I have James and Paul with me. It's been a while since James has been here.
Yep. Hey.
And
Adam was supposed to be here as well, but, you know, he flicked out on us.
What can you expect from a muscle-headed weight builder?
Well, we weren't having Chinese, so he probably was out.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in a while.
But, you know, I
wanted something other than Chinese as well because, you know, I didn't want to eat a whole lunch and then after we were done recording, need another whole lunch. So.
Well, I've got an extra sandwich here if you need it.
Okay. I think I'm pretty good.
I had two sandwiches. Nice, big, large waffle fry. Chick-fil-A, thank you for our Christmas dinner.
That's our unsolicited sponsorship this
this podcast brought to you by Chick-fil-A.
We wish.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
it's been a while since we've done an episode, partly because it's just been so stinking busy at work, I think, for all of us. But there's been some significant things that have gone on. One is the Sony hack, and we'll get to that a little bit later. We want to address a more seasonal issue first. And that is, I asked everybody to kind of come up with their top five tech items for 2014.
He asked me like 2 minutes ago, so just so you know.
Do you really have to think about it?
Somewhat.
I had been running that through my head. I mean, I could probably come up with a top 20. Because I have a top five and an honorable mention.
I have two. One I bought.
I can say everything that's on the list I bought. So Merry Christmas to me. I'm not giving it to anybody.
One item on my list I gave to somebody, but
that person thinks I bought it for me.
No comment.
So, well, you guys know me.
Yeah.
I do want to bring up another thing before we get into this.
Adam Snow, and he's not here. He switched from Android back to iOS because he had so many problems with his Nexus phone.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So, I wondered what was behind that because I saw him talking about getting a 6 Plus and I about passed out.
He actually bought an
iPhone 6 Plus and he ordered it a day before I ordered mine. So he got his before I got mine.
You should go back and pull out some of the greatest hits and have like snippets of him dogging.
Yeah,
iOS 6 and put together a little montage.
Hey, you know, as much as that would be fun, I reserve the right to change my mind, you know, and I have to give him some grace on that. You know, it takes a large man, you know, to admit that something's not the way he likes it and try something else.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what he wasn't satisfied with.
Because we talked about it for a long time. He was having and it's not just on his phone. It's actually a base Android problem. But he was not getting all of his texts or getting them in order.
That could be a carrier.
And, well, that's what he thought at first. So he switched carriers, and it didn't fix things. He switched twice. And he worked with Google,
and they sent him two or three Nexus 5s to replace his.
And eventually they said, just send your phone back and we'll give you a complete refund. So they knew it was an issue that they had on their end.
Wow. And then they brought out
the Nexus 6, and I kind of joked with Adam that, because I kind of got a run around with Verizon on my iPhone 6 Plus. So I joked with Adam that I ordered a Nexus 6 and everything, but he knew I wouldn't do it because the phone is actually inferior to the Nexus 5. It doesn't have the... as good a processor. They kind of stepped back in a hardware perspective when they went to the Nexus 6 to move forward with the software, which seemed kind of backwards to me as well. And it's kind of funny because although the Nexus, I've had issues with my Nexus 7 tablet. As a matter of fact, I have had issues so bad that it's actually non-functional at this point. Even when it did run KitKat 4.4, it was like, you know, running a 386 with Windows 95. It was bad.
And that was base, well, I mean, they only sell Nexus devices with base Android, right?
Correct. That was with base Android. And and now, that being said, I did have an original Nexus 7, but it's not like the hardware changed drastically between then and now.
Right.
And then the Nexus 9, their iPad competitor or full-size iPad Air competitor tablet, has not been getting good reviews either, and they've had really slow sales on it. So I'm just curious as what, you know, if Google's taken the eye off the ball because they're realizing hardware's not their thing or what.
That sounds like it may be the case.
Well, didn't they divest themselves of Motorola as well? That was their one of their big hardware.
Well, they bought Motorola. They bought Motorola thinking that they would be able to build all the Nexus devices themselves.
They wanted their patents and a lot of their patents.
Yeah, and they did want a lot of Motorola patents from Motorola Mobility. But there was some legal reason that they couldn't roll them in
in-house so that they could make devices more like Apple, where it would just be a Google device with Android on it.
So did they happen to pull key figures out of Motorola before they sold them?
They did. They pulled key figures. They kept most of the patent library, and the parts that they didn't keep, they licensed, you know, free license to themselves.
Okay.
And then they sold it to Lenovo, which is in and of itself kind of
disturbing. Not because so much that they're a
Chinese company, but, you know, that because they are a Chinese company, it's going to limit their marketability and market share in most of the U.S. and Western Europe.
Mm.
So, because IBM sold off their x86 server business to Lenovo.
All the ThinkPad devices.
Well, U.S. government, no more. We aren't buying those.
Yep.
And that was, you know, huge for IBM. That was a huge part of their x86 server business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a big deal.
So,
well, now that we've gone off on a tangent already,
yeah, what were we talking about?
Couple of minutes.
What's new?
So, Paul.
Yes.
Your top five, 2014.
Technically, I only have two.
Okay. The assignment was five.
I know.
And you could only come up with two.
It's like I was in school. I only
have. Well, good. I'll make up for yours.
This device I looked at the other day, because I kept seeing it on TV.
The Bacon
commercial.
Board?
And it's the wireless. It's two wireless devices. One's a thermostat. The other one is a carbon monoxide fire alarm.
The Nest.
Made by Nest.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Now, the thermostat I don't really need. I've got a pretty good digital thermostat. But I thought the CO and the fire detector would be nice because it's wireless and it gives you notifications on your phone. Mm-hmm. You can place it throughout the house. But then I started reading all the reviews, and it seemed like 80 to 90% of the reviews were saying false alarms were going off. And I thought, that's the last thing I need a false alarm on, is the fact that I think my house might be on fire or I might have poison gas in it.
Yeah.
My house. So I thought, you know, I think I'll sit around, maybe wait a couple more revs for that.
Well, you know, when the
I don't know much about it,
Nest fire alarm CO2, there was some problem with it.
Yeah,
initially, and it was, they sold them and people bought them, and then almost for 6 months they had to take them off the market and re-engineer. So I haven't, I know.
Now, Nest was founded by Tony Fadell, who is considered like the godfather of the iPod classic design.
Yeah. You know,
The click wheel. So
this is new. I haven't looked into it that much.
But they were acquired this year by Google. So
Google's putting this out, right? That's what I was under the impression, yeah.
Yeah, initially they were independent, but the thermostat was the first product, and then they came out with Rev 2 of it.
Yeah, and the thermostat's been out for 4 or 5 years.
So now that we're talking about Google hardware again, it might not be performing.
Well, it's part of Google's, they're beginning to look at in the home control, you know.
Yeah.
You know, how to manage your device as, your home as a device, or devices.
Well, it's it's this concept, and you hear GE and Hitachi Limited came out with this concept of the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. and the Nest devices are part of that Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. They produce data that is actionable, but then can also be collected and used for a, you know, for greater statistical analysis of, you know, how, when do fires occur, how many fires in a certain area occur. Because by going the both the Nest and the particularly their fire alarm route, it provides data back to Google, and that's what Google wants. They don't really care about selling you a phone or selling you that fire alarm. What they care about, or a fire detector, what they care about is the data it can provide them back that they can then market to you.
Sell so, more.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. I was in a hotel a couple weeks ago, and the wireless electric thermostat would not come off manual. So the thing never shut off. The fan never shut off. So I had the service guy come up. He was a young kid, and he was telling me that that's the way it was. And I said, no, that's not the way it is. It has an auto setting. No, they're all manual. I said, well, it can't be. Then it never shuts off, and it's right by my bed.
Yeah.
So he couldn't figure it out, but he pulls it off the wall. I ended up figuring out, I just popped the batteries and put it back in. It came back up, rebooted. But anyway, pops off the wall, you know, and I'm like, well, I understand it's in a central location, but really just it's just there because it's covering up the old wired thermostat. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, he goes, our regulars, they just take it over and put it on the nightstand, you know, when they come in. Like, I wouldn't mind being able to set that stuff from my phone.
Yeah.
But
I've looked at the Nest in the past. I have, you know, a programmable thermostat now made by Honeywell. Mm-hmm. It's not connected to the internet. It doesn't. And I looked at the Nest because I thought, well, that would be really cool. You know, I could get on the app on my phone and I could look at it and I could go, you know, when I get home, I want it to be 4 degrees cooler in the house than it is now because it's hotter today than I thought it would be. Or, you know, we're going away on a trip. I'm going to turn it down to 50, yeah. But I know on the plane ride back, I'm going to set it up so the house will be toasty when we get there, you know?
Well, being a two-story, sometimes at night, it's like, I don't want to get up and go downstairs and change the thermostat either.
I was an owner of a Nest for a couple of years, and they're probably the best feature, in my opinion, is the ability that it has to listen for activity in the house and know if someone is around. And so if someone's around, it notes that, and if it notes a particular time frame that that's happening within, say it notices activity until 10 o'clock and then the activity goes away, mm-hmm. At 10 o'clock at night, it decides, oh, this must be a nighttime setting. So I'm going to start working within the parameters you give me. So I'm going to turn down the thermostat a couple of degrees at night, especially in the winter.
I like that.
You know, so that's really cool. Now, the problem I ran into was, I had an aging heater, and we're not sure if it was Nest involved or not. What I do know was after a time, the control board went bad on my heating system. It had to be replaced. And then that new control board was no longer compatible voltage-wise with the Nest, because the Nest has very, or at least the Nest 1, we tried the 2 as well, the version 2 of it, and neither one would drive it. There was not enough voltage for the control board to know when to turn on the heat or the AC. Other than that, you know, if you're looking at a Nest seriously, they do have a way to look at your heating system and go, yes, these things are compatible or they are not. I would highly recommend you go to the Nest.com site and check that out before you purchase one. I would still have one if my heating system would allow me, but I wasn't really interested in paying $7,000 to get a new heating system when, you know, a couple $100 control board would fix it and sort of a dumber thermostat. So it is, I think, a better option if you can get it to work, because it will eventually become more efficient unless you are very tightly monitoring your existing thermostat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we
have fuel oil because I live out in the country. So, to my wife's chagrin, I set the thermostat in the wintertime to 65 degrees. Now,
you go upstairs in the house in the second story, heat rises,
and we live in an 87-year-old farmhouse.
But it has been completely redone from the inside, so all the drywall and everything had been taken out at one point, and really good insulation and, you know, insulated, so the house, the upstairs stays really warm. In the summertime, that's bad because the upstairs stays really warm, but...
mm-hmm.
But I leave it at 65, and when people complain it's cold, I go put a sweater on, wear your coat around, I don't care.
Yeah, ours is at 68. But like I said, I was originally looking at it at the fire alarm carbon monoxide detector. I thought it'd be a good gift for like my parents who are older, you mm-hmm. know, but I'm not going to give them something where I'm reading every other comment is that false alarms are happening.
All and I know with my folks, aren't quite as connected as I am. Okay, they're not as connected as I am. That's the point of the matter. And for them to want to monitor something remotely is a stretch. So
yeah,
in that case, you know, unless you want to monitor how your folks are doing, you know, with, you know, fire and carbon CO2, then...
I think it has a light carbon built in it, too.
Yeah, well. It does. And it changes color depending on what it's trying to tell you. And it talks, you know, you have a...
Well, one of the features they took out of it was that you could turn it off by tapping it. Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Fire Code came back and said, you can't turn off a fire alarm if there's a fire.
Mm-hmm. You know, which is why, like, code now, where we live,
you can be hardwired if you put a new one in.
Yeah.
For backup, so you can't pull the batteries out.
I mean, it's a great idea and great concept. I think it's hard to implement because the fire codes are different between... There's a national fire safety code, and then you have all the state's safety codes, and they differ. And some municipalities have fire safety codes. That's part of their building code. Like you were talking about, you know, it being wired in, or it couldn't be remote. And it also depends on how old the structure is and all this other stuff. And it's just, even though they're cheaply made and... But they're cheap to buy. In my opinion, the old fire alarms that you throw a 9-volt battery in are probably just as good as the Nest one. The Nest one's more for the neat factor, you know.
Yeah.
And they're because I mean you could buy probably 30 fire.
That'd be my gadget list.
Yeah.
But I think eventually this will become more de facto.
Well, in new construction and things like that, I don't see why you wouldn't go this way.
I mean, you know, everything's gonna have wireless control too. I think that it's the way to go, but it seems buggy.
Yeah.
That's not something I want to buy that's buggy. I don't want fire alarm going off in the middle of the night and then everybody racing out to go, oh, that's a false alarm, you know. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time on that. The other thing I bought, because I only have two, is I bought a drone for my daughter for Christmas, actually.
I bought a drone for my daughter.
Yeah, well, she asked for a remote control helicopter. He's been asking
for
one.
Did you get it from Dayton Drones? Or?
No, I bought a little. It's a mini. It's about the size of your palm. Uh-huh. Made by a company called Hubsan. A little four-bladed rotocopter.
So $50. Next time we see Paul, he'll have stitches in his forehead.
Yeah. So we're going to see how that works. I got the... it hasn't come yet, but I got the repair kit. I already got that. So I've got extra blades, extra body, stuff like that. And it's got a little low-res camera on it, too. So, let's see. It's supposed to be very easy to fly, as drones go, because some of them aren't.
Likely story. Those little remote control helicopters are incredibly hard to fly.
Well, the four-bladed, this thing has some kind of auto-correcting
stability in it. They counter-rotate, so you won't get the spin. So, you don't need a collective to keep it stable.
Right. And it's got its own controller. It's not a smartphone controller or anything like that. So we'll see how it goes. I figure she's 11. By the time she's 20, there's going to be a lot of drones out there. Maybe we'll buy a Phantom next year.
Shall we take bets on how long the drone will last?
Is Amazon delivering this drone with a drone?
Yeah. Going to hover right outside and drop it in the front yard.
Drop it down.
But it should be fun. Hopefully, play with a harass the cat and the dog, or whatever she can do if she can fly it. But looking forward to getting that.
And that's it.
I've only got two gadgets.
Oh, my! Something that cool happened though is my wife and the girls went shopping Black Friday, and the radio station was out there out the local shopping center giving out iPad Airs. And my wife won one, and my daughter won one, and there were only 8 given out.
Oh, wow.
So they came home with 2 iPad Airs.
That's pretty cool.
iPad 2 Airs.
Very cool.
Very nice.
So, but I'm not getting into one, so.
They won't share.
My wife says, you have your Surface. I'm like, so? I want an iPad, too. I sold my iPad.
Okay, so now that you've had 20 minutes to think about it, James.
Well, I'll... You know, the big gadget I got this year was a Retina iMac. And I know a lot of people, especially geeks, go, 5K, what are you going to do with that? I mean, come on.
Oh, really? I can think. I'm like,
hey. I'm drooling over here just thinking about a Retina iMac with a 5K screen.
And, you know, being the good nerd that I am, I got the upgraded graphics. And, you know, eventually once I got it in my house, I had already pre-ordered, you know, max amount of memory. So from a third party, and loaded that up. And I you know, when I bought it, I was at the point where do I get an iMac or do I go with a Mac Pro? And when they announced the Retina display, I was like, okay, I'll buy it. You know, I wasn't entirely convinced. And once I got it out of the box and set up, it was like, holy crap. You know, monitors will never be the same. I mean, it's just quite amazing how different it really makes things feel. You get definitely deeper blacks. You don't get as much backlight bleed through. I have a standard Dell 27 IPS next to it, and you can see the difference. You know, it's night and day. Mm. So reading text is obviously one of the big pluses to it, but... I'm just amazed at how well it responds. There, I had a little bit of hesitation, thinking there's going to be some latency in the refresh. I see none of that, you know.
Have you run any 4K video on it?
Yeah, and it's pretty stunning.
Yeah,
you know,
that's pretty cool. And an actual 4K is awesome.
And you well, know,
now you're going to have to go out and buy a red camera so that you can take, you know. Go get pictures of your family at Christmas. And hey, we're the only family with 4K Christmas video.
Yeah. And everybody will be ticked off at us because it takes them, you know, hours to download, you know, our little 30-second Vine or 6-second Vine. I have a little hobby of photography that, you know, I'm not even close to professional, but with the resolutions that those new camera bodies can generate. What has been really quite slick is the Retina API that Apple has built, so that you get the, you know, very fine font renderings, but then it's smart enough to know that this is a high DPI image, and it will display it pixel for pixel if it can. And that within, you know, their apps, you know, like, you know, iPhoto and Aperture and, you know, the video, Final Cut is also content aware in that way. And that has really been quite impressive. So, you know, that could probably be gadgets 1 through 4 for me right there. That was certainly my gadget budget for the year.
Yeah.
So, not Chris's, that was maybe like a tenth of his, but, so Adam got an iPhone 6 Plus before Chris did, and I got an iMac Retina, so we're wondering how dedicated the Apple guy really is here, you know, because we're getting gadgets before he is.
Well, I love iMacs. I'm waiting for the 4K cinema display, which should be in 2015. Because I live on Retina MacBook Pros, and so. But that being said, my youngest
27 inches of Retina cannot be beat.
Oh, I know it can't be beat.
My youngest daughter came to me and she's like, she uses an 11-inch MacBook Air, and
our school district, there's no textbooks, it's all electronic, and yep. They turn their homework in electronically. And so she takes it to school every day. She came home and she goes, you know, I don't really want a monitor on my desk to plug my laptop in, but I'd like an iMac. Now, she's not looking at a 4K. She wants just the little 21-inch 1.4. Mm-hmm. That way, she could blow things up at home. And you know, and they do some interesting things. Like this week before Christmas, they have a video project due that they've had to do. And she was kind of ticked because they wouldn't let her use iMovie. And she had to use Windows Movie Maker. Because the school PCs,
our school doesn't have very many PCs anymore because they bought into the whole, if you're not bringing your own device, then you're going to use a Chromebook. So they bought Chromebooks, which you can't do a lot of video editing on. And then, so the computer labs, there's a couple that's still full of Windows 7 running old Dells. And so we're going to use Windows Movie Maker to make a movie. Oh, so she's been struggling with that, but thank God
she hasn't noticed the 4K IMAX in the Apple Store, because if she had,
this is what I want for my birthday.
All right. We'll just have to let her know it's there.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, guys.
Sure, anything. Honestly, you're going to get one eventually. You know it.
You know it.
I will own every Apple product ever made.
Have you owned a cinema display?
I own one now.
You do have one now?
and you know, James was talking about just how the quality of the 4K display.
Yeah,
5K. Or
5K? Yeah.
I have the original 23-inch, it's really a 24-inch monitor, but it's 23-inch viewable cinema display that they brought out when the first aluminum MacBook Pros, before they were actually called MacBook Pros, they were aluminum MacBooks.
Yep, I had one of those.
I still have mine, because my daughter, oldest daughter, used it until she went to college this year.
Yeah, well, I think we have one of those.
And I had the 23-inch cinema display to go with it. That monitor is still the best monitor I have ever owned.
Really?
And next to it, I have a newer HP 23-inch and a brand new Acer 23-inch. Both rated super highly, but just like James said, very little bleed through. And this is, you're talking about a monitor that's now, what, that's probably at least 6 years old, 7 years old.
Older than that.
Yeah.
It's the blacks are blacker, very little bleed through.
I don't think there's a bad pixel on that monitor, and I use it every day. When I compare it to the HP, and the HP was their top-of-the-line monitor, the HP has a matte finish on it. That alone takes the brightness level down a whole...
Yeah, it softens it up, doesn't it?
It's horrible. Yeah. I have it turned all the way up, and it's like, you're dim compared to my other monitor.
Yeah.
But the blacks are more gray and everything else, and it's only a couple years old, and then the Acer's brand new. And it's blacker than the HP, but it's still not as black as a 7-year-old or 8-year-old monitor.
I'm sure somebody listening would disagree with me, but in the years that I've seen Acer monitors, none of them have impressed me.
Yeah. Or it's not an Acer, it's an Asus.
Okay, that's different.
Yeah, sorry.
And I actually had buyer's regret after I bought the Asus. I actually wish I had bought a Lenovo. Because for almost the same price, the Lenovo was a 5-point touchscreen.
Is that Lenovo monitor, the one that was the widescreen monitor, has that been very popular?
You know, Lenovo, they're getting out a lot of that stuff. Because it's hard to get some of that stuff anymore, even off of Amazon. Like, Lenovo had a great tablet. It was a 23-inch tablet computer, and they had one that was 60. And it was called a tabletop computer, and it meant to lay it down on your table, and they had all these games for it. You can't. They still have a couple models out there. You can pick them up at Best Buy. But they're like $3,000, you know, for a Core i3.
Yeah.
And like Amazon had the smaller models, and they've since discontinued those. They must not have sold. But, you know, like many, I hate to say this about electronics companies, but almost all the Asian electronics companies who actually are, you know, Samsung, Sony, all of them, they don't really think about the products that they're building. They just build all these variants of the same products, and they throw them out there. And then, you know, after a while, they'll start paring them down based upon what's selling and what isn't selling.
That's a shotgun
strategy. And but it's not effective from a marketing or engineering strategy.
because I'm building all these different models, which must be changed and packaged separately. So I'm actually spending more money to build. You know, Apple fell into that trap back in the late 80s and early 90s with the whole, you know, they had
the Gil Emilio era.
You had Power Max and you had Performas. And there was a safe. They were the same stupid machines, but one was called a Performa and one was called a Power Max. But the Performas, there would be 9 different SKUs for the same spec hardware, but it would have different software bundles in it. Well, from a marketing perspective, that was awful. They spent so much more money marketing because, and then people couldn't tell, do I have the Performa 695 or do I have the Performa 2020 or, you know, it's the same machine. And I think that's biting a lot of those makers in the butt. I mean, Samsung's a good example. I have the Samsung Galaxy S5. I have the Samsung Galaxy S5 Mini. I have the Samsung Galaxy S5 blah, and this and that. There's 9 different models. Well, which model do you have? Well, it's an S5 something, you know. And in the reality, the only one that really sells is the regular S5. So why are they producing all the others? You know, it's probably, particularly since it's marginal, their model is like Cisco as far as margin position goes, and that is they're making this much on every device, and they're just hoping to sell a bazillion of them. So why would I have a whole bunch of devices out there that would eat away at my margin position?
Well, one reason I could see, and you see this often enough with electronics retailers, is they want an exclusive. So they change it just enough to sell to one big box store that, you know, Amazon or another box store doesn't have. So price matching gets a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does.
I change model numbers and things like that.
That's the old appliance.
Well, the funny Best thing Buy model is numbers won't match up to.
That's the appliance route, you know. Yeah. I have the Kenmore and I have the LG and I have the. Well, wait a minute. The company who makes LG makes the Kenmore and.
Yeah. Okay, so gadget number 2. Now, it's really not new for this year, but they did update them this year, and that's the Intel NUCs, the next unit of computing. And there are these tiny, smaller, I mean, they're maybe, what, 3.5 by 3.5 by 2 inch. And you can get them anywhere from a Core i3 to a Core i5. And you can run them as a straight PC. Personally, I have one, and it runs a personal version of VMware at the house. And I think it might pull 15 watts, you know. And you hook that little booger up to some USB expansion or a NAS, and you have a nice little home server that just sits there very quietly. It has one fan, and it might move. I mean, it's always moving. Don't get me wrong there. But you might hear it once in a blue moon, you know, if it's doing a virus scan or something on, you know, one of the internal VMs. But, you know, admittedly, they're as much as, you know, a commodity PC, but, you know, due to the fact they don't use a lot of energy, they are a great gadget to have, especially if you're a network nerd or, you know, an IT nerd and you just want something around the house to serve up some services like DNS or, you know, something like that. It is a great tool.
How much memory is that?
You can max them out to 16 gigs.
It takes regular DIMMs?
It takes SO DIMMs.
Yeah.
Oh.
For laptops.
Yeah.
So mine's got 16 gigs in it. I run a little, if you've not heard of the distribution Zentyal, Zentyal, is an awesome little distro. Runs Samba 4. So if you want to run an Active Directory domain, a 2008 Active Directory domain, and don't want to, you know, buy Windows licenses, you can get the Zentyal Community Edition for free at, of course, Zentyal.com. So head there. It's got a web interface. It'll run your DNS, your DHCP. It'll do quite a bit. And so if you want to be that nerdy at home, feel free to look them up. They're a great little solution, just getting their start.
Is that like a competitor to Raspberry Pi then?
No,
because this is a full Intel processor. Yeah. It's like
mine has a Core i5. It's a dual core, but it's the kind of i5 actually has a hyper-threaded. So most if on a desktop solution, you can count on the i5s not being hyper-threaded. But These are the more mobile variant, and so they give them those two extra logical cores to get a little bit more oomph out of them. And you know, it's like maybe a 1.3 gigahertz processor, you know, at rest. But honestly, I don't need a lot of oomph to power these kinds of VMs. And you know, I could go out and buy like a little Think server or something off of Amazon for about the same price, but it's gonna, you know, its power profile is gonna be much, much higher. Now, admittedly, it's not gonna be as expandable either, but I know that going in. So I would give a NUC a good look. And
nice. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm looking at Amazon right now. You can buy the i3 with dual HDMI, gigabit LAN. It's a 3217U i3, Core i3 for 250. And for 320, you can get the same thing with a Core i5, a 4250U. Yeah.
Now, there are multiple models, of course, like Chris is referring to. The one I got in particular has an mSATA slot for an SSD, and it also has a slot for a 2.5-inch hard drive. So if you want to put spinning disk in it, you can, and it'll be on the local bus. But, of course, you're limited to laptop hard drives, mm-hmm. which, you know, right now I just have the mSATA SSD in it. I think I got a Samsung one, 256 gigs. It's one of the, their EVO-compatible, line. Yeah. And it just little zings along, so...
Well, you don't even, even if you bought like a 32 gig mSATA.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, I have two Synologies. And those would actually, if I had a top 20 list, those would be on my top 20 list.
And actually, I run ESX off of a little USB nub that I stick in it. And then I use the 256 gig SSD as my storage repo.
Yeah. But, like, a lot of the new NAS boxes, like the Synologies, will do iSCSI right out of the box. Mm-hmm. So. Use a USB key. Don't even put something in it. Have it go over your LAN to your Synology and run all your VMFS data stores off
that. That's great if you're only running one or two boxes.
Yeah. Yep. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I've looked at those. I haven't bought into it. I actually built my home server is a little bit beefier because it has to have a lot of storage, even though I have two NAS devices out there. Internally, it needs a lot of storage for what it's doing.
Yeah, but say if you want to throw like, I don't know if you run a domain at home, but if you did, you could have, one domain controller there, and you could have put a secondary one, do replication on that little box.
Yeah, exactly.
So, good toy for IT nerds, certainly.
Yeah, $350, that's not bad price.
No, not at all.
You know, so you can put it somewhere out of the way. It's, like I said, it's not going to draw a lot of electricity. It doesn't get very hot. You know, you just make sure the area is clean and, give it a network port. You can get wireless up to 802.11 AC adapters if you want to go wireless. So you could practically hide it anywhere in your home if you really wanted to, just for a, close-in backup or replication point.
It does have an RJ45.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
There's Ethernet on it, too, so...
It's giving you a little wireless bridge.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to use it as like a, it wouldn't really make a great gateway device because it's only got the one physical NIC on it. But if you really wanted to, I guess you could put a USB NIC off of it and you'd still get gigabit. But, there's all sorts of applications. If you wanted to put one in your car, let it power something, for your, your car, your camper, something like that. There's all sorts of DIY projects you could throw one of these guys into, and it would probably work really well.
Very cool.
That's cool.
That one was not one considered on my top 20.
I didn't.
Although it might be now.
And I would expect new ones coming out in January. That's typically when Intel seems to push them out. So
the CES is going to happen. Yeah. So
the version I had debuted last January, but I've been using it for 4 or 5 months now. But I think that needed to be... And they had a version, like I said, prior to that. And each year, they figure out little bumps in their road. Like the first year, they didn't come with power cables. That was an extra buy. And, the model I got, they figured out, okay, we need to provide a North American SKU or a Canadian, or, well, that would be probably North American, or a European SKU, and, you know, for the power adapters and whatnot. And I think next year they're going to start including the wireless and a lot of that on some of the SKUs. So it'll just become more
that
and more easy.
That this year should drop down in price.
I would expect so, yes.
That would be very cool.
So those are probably my two main gadgety things. I'm sure Chris is going to talk about some of them, the 6 Plus. But I'm not going to claim that one as mine since he's actually using one. I'm still on a 5S. So I won't steal his thunder on that one. But that's my 20-minute roundup. I got 3 out of that. So,
mm-hmm. So I actually have, like I was saying, I could probably do a top 20, probably a top 100. So I actually, when I made my list, I have 5 and an honorable mention. I actually have a couple honorable mentions. But the first 3 on my list are the MacBook Pro with Retina display, the 13-inch model, the current model.
Right. Most recent one.
Most recent one has the latest Core i7. Mine does. I did the build to order. Core i7, 512 gig SSD, and 16 gig of RAM. And for me, the 16 gig of RAM is the killer because I had the previous model that maxed out at 8. My oldest daughter went off to college. It was less than a year old. It became hers.
You've noticed us talk about this before. This is Chris's upgrade path. He has children, so he can get new gear.
Yeah. Exactly. Things fall off my lap and go in new gear. But it is by far, and even the 8 gig one, and prior to that, I had the
original 15-inch Retina display with 16 gig of memory in it that was stolen out of my truck. But the 13-inch is the
right combination of size, weight, and power with all the features you would want. And there's some cool things that, you know, most people don't think about with the MacBook Pro, particularly versus a MacBook Air. I have a lot of colleagues who they live by their 13-inch MacBook Airs. They, you know, pry it from their cold, dead hands would be difficult.
That's what I drive most of my work on. But I would love a Retina display.
The Retina display is one thing, the smooth video, the blacker blacks. I use Final Cut Pro a lot, and the fact that it can give you a full, even though it's blowing up the GUI for Final Cut Pro when you're watching the preview video and editing the video, it's actually giving you exactly what that video looks like and the correct pixel.
Content aware, it's just like you were talking about on there.
And it is phenomenal, particularly to do, because sometimes I'll have 2 or 3 edit rolls up with my main display because I'm trying to figure out which clip I want to put in there. And it just works phenomenally. And there's no hiccups with this machine. And I mean, I do everything on it. This podcast is being recorded on it as we speak. I do video editing. You know, I create documents for work. I literally live on this machine. And it is my right hand. You know, if I had to give up everything else, I couldn't give up this.
Can I have your phone? Dang it.
It's the other. So, but in my bag, you know, I'm a person. I use a second screen a lot. Sometimes I use a
iPad 4, but, you know, the first one that had the lightning cable on it. It sits at home. We use it at home. It works great.
But I never saw, other than the feature of it being faster and lighter,
a compelling reason to go from that device to an iPad Air or an iPad Air 2. I just
hadn't. And I had actually quit carrying the iPad with me because it got quite heavy.
And so, but
I occasionally needed a Windows machine, and I do have a Windows 10 VM that I use for, I'm doing a little bit of development with on my MacBook Pro, but 10 is a little buggy. So I was carrying around my original Surface Pro. Well, that thing is really heavy. You talk about iPad 4 being heavy, that thing's super heavy. So when I needed a machine, I had that. Well,
I've since moved on to a Surface Pro 3. And this is my tablet.
Yes, I could actually use it as my main computer. Because I have this, several of my colleagues who are not Mac guys.
But wanted a machine that's like a Mac,
which the Surface Pro is
probably the closest thing you'll ever find made by a that runs Windows natively that is not a Mac, as close to a Mac.
You know, Microsoft doesn't put any crapware on it.
It has an incredibly great touchscreen on it, and the stylus is really cool.
And what I mainly use a lot of this for is I take notes, and I use OneNote across all my devices. But it has the OCR and handwriting recognition. So I'll take notes in OneNote, it'll OCR it, and then it's on my MacBook Pro for use later.
Okay. So before we move on from...
But this is more of a toy.
Okay. So I just out of curiosity, I have a Newton. Mm-hmm. You remember the Newton?
Absolutely.
Okay. How different is it OCR-wise with your handwriting?
It is better than the Newton because there's so much more processing power behind the Surface Pro. It's a Core i5. I mean, it's a full laptop in that sense. I use it as a tablet mainly because the desktop capability...
Curious, you know, how much are you going back and revising after you scribble a note down?
Very little.
Because it does a really good job of... So one of the things the Newton was poor at was that if you didn't write everything clearly...
Well, even the Palms had the, well, this is our prescribed,
correct,
you know, alphabet.
Yeah, if you didn't
and
use...
that's fine, I understand. I don't expect it to run miracles and understand my cursive, or let alone my printing, as, you know, unless I'm trying to conform to them.
So this does a good job in learning your handwriting. Because my scrawlings are a combination of cursive and
print.
And so it does a really good job. Occasionally it'll miss certain letters like C and S at the beginning of a word. It has problems with capital letters more than it does anything.
Smaller sample set.
Yeah. And it's not perfect, but it works well enough for me that, and I'm not revising it too much. Sometimes I'll have pages and pages of notes, and I won't revise any of it because it's still clear, legible enough that I can read it even though there's mistakes in it.
Is there like an OCR plug-in to OneNote that you have to load?
I have another app, and then I copy it after it OCRs into OneNote.
Oh, okay. Okay, I thought you were annotating like right on the...
Well, supposedly OneNote's getting that capability, and Microsoft has an application for their Windows 8 phone that does that. I forget what the API is called, and it's supposed to be in OneNote on the Surface, but it hasn't surfaced yet.
So is that OCR app pretty good then? I need it. Is it free?
Yeah, I'm Windows Phone. Yeah.
No, for the Surface.
No, I pay for mine.
Oh, I could use something like that.
Okay, so it is. You called it kind of more of a toy.
But
cost wise, is it closer to a laptop or a tablet?
It's closer to a Mac.
Okay.
It would be, you know, it's an Ultrabook in price.
Okay.
I mean, this is a Core i5 with 8 gig of RAM, which is the max you can get in it. Which my previous Surface Pro was the Core i5 with 4 gig of RAM, which was the max at the time, and it's got a 256 SSD. I have a buddy who bought. He hasn't quite figured it. He keeps going, I love openness. I can't see myself buying an Apple product because they're not open. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's not like Windows is any more open.
What are you
Android
open for?
That much more open? but
what are you open to?
He won't buy a Mac. But he went and bought one of these because he loved the sexiness of having, you know,
an exclusive device.
You know, I don't get on anybody's case because of how they justify what they enjoy. Yeah. That's fine.
No, I agree. I the argument I think is funny.
Although I do pick on Adam from time to time.
Yeah. But he bought the Core i7 version, which has the same 8 gig of RAM, but it has the 512 gig SSD. It actually is more costly than a fully decked out 13-inch Retina display.
MacBook Pro.
Wow.
So, just being said, and I mean,
I go there.
I have the dock.
The dock is really nice for this because at home I have a keyboard and mouse, and that's what that Asus monitor connects to is that dock.
Okay.
But again, it's a super nice device. Sometimes I actually only take this device, particularly if it's a day trip, because it is. I mean,
it's relatively light, and it's not as light as
an iPad. It's a 13.
This is bigger.
It's a 13 inch.
Because I've got the Surface Pro. It's got a new, like a new kick
yeah,
kind of on it, or the elevated keyboard.
You
pop back.
Well, and the keyboard's also backlit. I mean, you can look at all the features on it, and you're like, I wonder where that comes from.
It's much nicer that they pulled this keyboard up off the ground a little bit too.
Yeah.
I don't like it really laying flat.
To be honest, I just type straight onto my iPad.
I don't have a problem typing. As a matter of fact, the keyboard I keep folded up behind it most of the time.
Yeah.
And I type when I am typing, I'm typing on the keyboard on that.
It's got a nice screen on it. It does. Size. I like the size.
It's an extremely good device. I'll tell you, a lot of time spent with it. I mean, I do use Word and PowerPoint on it occasionally. But the most time spent on it is playing
Angry Birds,
a Star Wars game.
Okay.
And watching Plex.
I use mine to watch Plex too because I love the resolution.
But you know, it becomes
missing my fingers on the back of it.
Oh yeah, I keep like if I'm working at my desk at a hotel room or I'll have it up here and have Plex on while I'm working on something else.
But I'll tell you what, it's not as nice to hold that as it is an iPad. An iPad is much more comfortable to hold.
It's kind of
an awkward folding device.
Well, it's got hard edges, and that's my only complaint. Thick. Yeah. It's
half as thick as the original.
Well, I sit there and I can't figure out whether I want to read something in portrait or landscape. And I go back and forth with it because I like to hold it.
One of the things I do have a complaint about it is there's no screen lock on it like you have an iOS.
Hmm.
You know how you can flip up on the thing and say lock the screen, it'll stay in that?
Yeah. I haven't found one on here. And I mean, I'm really fluent in Windows 8 now. I know where all the charms bars are and
everything. So, but it's a good device. And I would say if you were looking at something, it'll never replace my MacBook Pro. But it's a great device. And for most people, that's all they would ever need. And I can see where Microsoft is going with it.
It actually will probably have more play with Windows 10, where they're doing their own version of... I forget what they call it, but the name is similar to, you know, where between your iPhone and your...
The handshake.
Well, where you hand off. It's similar to handoff. Yeah. Except what theirs is when you put it in the dock, it switches over from being in Metro mode to Windows mode, which now in 10, your Metro... you actually get a start menu, and all your Metro apps show up in the start menu.
Okay.
I'm going to bring this up, and you can shut me down all you want if you like. I just know that when the original Windows phones came out, they came out with a version of the Windows interface or operating system, and then they had promised an upgrade and never came through with it. Do you have any worry about that happening with your Surface?
Well, since that's the x86 version, no.
Okay.
And my original Surface Pro came with Windows 8. This one came with 8.1. And they provided, you know, the updates and everything to 8.1 on it. And same with, I had an RT for a while, too, that I've since sold. And the RT one even got all the updates.
Okay.
And my phone that I use in Europe is a Windows mobile phone, mainly because it was just cheap.
And you wanted something different to play with.
Yeah, I did. And it came with 8, and it got the 8.1, and it's a cheap one. It's a Lumia 520, so it's there on their low end of smartphones. And it got the update and ran fine with the update. As a matter of fact, if Adam were here, he could tell you how much he hated it, because during his hiatus from having a phone, since he had to send his Nexus back before he got his iPhone 6, I loaned him that phone.
Oh. Because it's a completely unlocked phone. So,
but... you know, I, as part of my workflow, that device works for me. And then the third one is my iPhone 6 Plus. I don't know that I will ever buy an iPad ever again with a phone this big. It's kind of like an iPad Nano.
Yeah, I've been looking at that and contemplating, you know, what I would use my iPad for once I have a screen.
Because I now understand a lot of Adam's argument about having the Galaxy Note and the bigger screen. Mm-hmm. Things that I used to do on my iPad... I do exclusively on my phone. But one of the reasons I moved to it is, again, I travel a lot. I read a lot of books on planes.
Mm-hmm.
And 5S was great, but, you know, it was short pages and you're flipping a lot.
Mm-hmm. This is actually much easier to see.
Well, I mean, you get comfortable with that real fast.
Yeah.
This is why I went to this S4 for real estate. And now I think I might be ready to go.
Now, the only thing I complain about right now, and it has nothing to do with the phone. The phone is, I have the Apple leather case, which Adam laughs at me about, because, as a matter of fact, he called me a baller when he found out I had this. Because it's an expensive case.
Yeah.
But it doesn't slide out of my hand. It doesn't really provide a lot of protection. It's more scratch protection. And if it does fall on its face, it does have a lip that, you know, will keep the screen from touching the... But
yeah, I'm going to repeat the baller comment because I think I paid $9 for mine.
Yeah, well, I have a $9 case that I ordered off of Amazon, and it was like a silicone sleeve with tinfoil wrapped around it. I mean, it wouldn't have protected your phone to save your life. This has more protection.
I'm gonna say this, and you can hate me, but you spend that much cash on a device you carry around, try and hold on to it. That's all I'm gonna say. You know, this is the reason why if I had children, I would not provide them with an iPhone out of the gate. It's you need to learn to be responsible with your expensive stuff.
Exactly. Exactly.
So.
I agree with you.
My 11-year-old has an iPhone 6.
It's my wife. It's my wife who has the issue.
All right.
She's had her. She has a 5C, and we've already had the screen replaced on it. It's not a year old.
Our 17-year-old has broke two screens. She's broken a LifeProof case. She's broken a Mophie. She's just disaster. My 11-year-old has an iPhone 6. We've never had a problem with any
now,
devices.
Now, we live on a farm with horses, and my girls stick their phones in their back pockets. Now, they both have LifeProof cases.
back pockets, sorry.
I know.
They all carry them in their back pockets.
Neither of them has ever had a broken screen. Okay. Their phones are not scratched. But my wife, I don't know how she does it, but she has a
LifeProof case on her phone now, but she had an OtterBox,
and she somehow dropped it and smashed the screen. I haven't figured that one out yet.
Must have dropped it on a rock.
I have no idea what she did.
Or a hammer fell.
Yeah.
Off.
Well, when she had her 4S, she had a case on it, and she dropped it, and didn't realize for a month that she'd broken the back glass because it had a case on it. You know, she opened it up to clean out in the case. All this glass falls out. Now,
luckily, that's a cheap fix. That's like $20 at the Apple store, but. The only thing my oldest daughter's phone has had she because she literally hates changing technology. She we've had her battery replaced in her iPhone 5, and that's it. So, you know, she's actually using a phone for the amount of time you're supposed to use it.
I tend to use a phone for a couple of years before I get rid of it.
I gotta have new toys.
Really?
You haven't figured that out. Okay, so that's my first three.
our second three will happen in about 8 years after we talk about Sony.
Yeah. I got two more in there pretty quick.
Okay.
So number four is Little Bits. And if you're not familiar with Little Bits, it is an electronics prototyping system. And it's they're little components like Lego blocks, but they have electronics in them. Some have lights and switches and battery or USB hookups and servos or motors and... they have a Wi-Fi module. They actually have a Little Bits Arduino module that lets you use it. It connects in, and you have an Arduino control over, you know, servos and lights and all this other stuff. It is the coolest. I mean, I grew up with you go to Radio Shack, and your parents would get you the kit that's on a plate, and it had springs, and it would have the components attached to the springs, and you would take a wire and you connect this resistor to this capacitor or to this LED.
And you made it light.
And, you know, you'd make a radio and then you'd take them all off and you'd make it do something else. And
we'd make light switches and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it was so you could learn how to use electronics. Well, this is what, you know, is kind of the modern day age of this. So I bought the Little Bits basic set. They are not cheap. It's like $99 for the basic set, and that's only 12 Little Bits. So that makes them just under $10 a piece.
How many different things can you build with the basic set?
You can build, like, they said, like 1,200 different projects. Yeah.
That's cool. Where do you get this now?
Littlebits.cc.
Or you can order them. You can get them at Radio Shack. They have them at Radio Shack. Or you can get them at MCM Electronics. I got mine. I actually ordered mine off of Amazon. It was the best price I could find. But they even have a home automation kit. So you can, like, build stuff to automate your home and your appliances and connects to your Wi-Fi. It's pretty cool. And it's something that you buy the basic set and you can build on. You can buy individual little bits too to do different things. And then lastly on my list, and then I will give an honorable mention.
Okay.
Is the Raspberry Pi A plus B plus. So I probably own 6 or 8 Raspberry Pis at this point. And my son has 2. And
I got a couple.
They are the coolest. If you want to learn about Linux, my son has learned more about Linux from the Raspberry Pi than he has playing. And my kid is the one who won't use Ubuntu. He actually went to Debian and he put Ubuntu on his system, straight Debian on his system, using the Git site.
Okay. Well, there is Raspbian, which is pre-compiled. Well, yeah, it's Debian, but it's been compiled for the Pi, so you're getting as much native power as you can out of that thing, rather than running something not quite compiled for it.
I mean, he uses it as a desktop system, Linux system.
Yep.
On his, he has a B that he uses his on. I've taken 4 of my B pluses are security cameras. I bought the little camera module. I've compiled all the code and made remote security cameras that hang in various places in our farm, and they feed back to one of my NAS devices, and I can then review all the it takes stills and videos. That's pretty cool how it works. And I throw the A-plus in there because as soon as I can get a shipment of A-plus boards, which they were supposed to be delivered yesterday, they are actually replacing all my B-pluses in those security cameras.
Explain to the folks what the difference is?
So the B-plus has 512 gig of RAM, HDMI out, composite audio video out, and input. And what else does it have on it? I think that's it. And then, and it has 4 USB ports and RJ45 out. The A plus is the same board minus 2 of the USB ports and 256 meg of RAM. And the big thing is so the B plus board is more of a development prototype board, or if you want to use it for GUI applications. The A plus board is for more of an embedded project like the video camera thing, where you're not going to run a GUI on top of it. You just need a command line interface and things like that. And so I'm going to take some of my B pluses back to do other things and put A pluses in the enclosures for them. But it's pretty cool. I mean, for like $60, you can build a video camera that has infrared. Yeah.
I'm gonna add on to Chris and say there's a project. It started off as a Kickstarter called Kano, K-A-N-O. If you look it up on online, you'll find it. But it's a hitified version of a Raspberry Pi, where they give you the board, they give you a case, they give you a Bluetooth keyboard, Ethernet cable, video cable. Pretty much everything except a monitor, which you can hook up to your HDMI TV to build your own computer, with all the components there. So it gives, girls and boys, the absolute everything they need to build something, and within, I'd say a half an hour, see something on the screen that they can play with. So it's they've done a lot of the hard work for the kid. They have great documentation, and it teaches them to code. So if you have a kid that's mildly interested in computing, I think a Kano is anywhere, it's just above $100 maybe, depending on shipping. But I would wholeheartedly recommend one.
And there's other variants. There's the BeagleBoard out there.
Yep.
There's the Intel Galileo. They run... Instead of running the Intel Galileo is actually a Pentium-based processor, so it runs straight Linux. The BeagleBoard is an ARM-based processor like the Raspberry Pi, but they have, like Raspberry Pi, they have a phenomenal website and user community. And, it's just
not only do you learn to code, but it's taking electronics to that next step.
So you're adding a microcontroller to something to have intelligent, electronic.
The Beagle boards were built with a dimension so they'll fit inside an Altoids can. So you can use those as a case and then mount them up however you want.
And they have GPIO or general purpose IO ports or on them pins. And you can get shields for them. I have one called Pybrella.
Yep.
That
gives you a physical on and off switch, and you can code through it with Python. And he has a bazillion LEDs, and there's all kinds of projects you can use Pybrella for. And I know there's another one that is an LED. It's like an array of LED lights, and you can use it to build like graphics equalizers and things that are all run by the Raspberry Pi or the BeagleBoard. They work with almost all of them, and yep. Arduino. So, and then my honorable mention is the HP Stream 13 and 11-inch laptops. You've seen the commercials for them.
I've been interested. Do you have one?
I bought the 13-inch at Sam's Club for $229.
Oh, really?
It's 2 gig of RAM, 32 gig SSD, runs the full version of Windows 8.1. I've got Office. I put Office 2013 on it, and it downloaded the rest of my apps from my Microsoft profile off the cloud and installed those.
So it doesn't require a monthly service fee?
Nope.
Just Wi-Fi?
Just Wi-Fi. And I still have 13 gig of space on the SSD with all those apps and everything on there. But, you know, and they give you a terabyte of free space.
On OneDrive.
Well, you get that on OneDrive, and then HP gives you a terabyte on theirs. Okay. Now, I don't like HP's terms of service, so I'm not using theirs.
Trying to pull people in their cloud.
Yeah, but, and I already have everything set up to go to OneDrive anyway. But what impressed me is, so, you know, it's kind of the concept of netbooks coming back.
Playing in the low-end market, yeah.
Yeah, they're bigger machines. The 13-inch is a nice machine. It's physically, the outside dimensions is bigger than my MacBook Pro. Which I thought was strange because I set my MacBook Pro on and I'm like, and there's like a half inch on each side. But so it's a full size keyboard, mediocre sound, you know, the speaker capability. It just, there's no volume in it. If it's loud in the room, you can't hear what it's doing.
Well, for under $300, what do you expect?
But the reason I got it is we've broken 3 iPads working out on farm equipment and on cars and trucks out in the farm where, you know, we take it out because we need to look at a YouTube video to figure out how to.
Yeah.
How to do something, and it gets knocked off the tractor and all of a sudden broken screen. So I bought it to take out to do that. And unfortunately, as much as I love Linux, YouTube is not a thing that works great with most Linux distributions. Ubuntu's better, but the hardware I had available to put it on something that I was willing to throw away if it got broken, didn't handle YouTube well.
You have a wireless extender out there?
I have two.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get wireless all the way out to the farthest barn where they teach writing lessons. That way, we can put an IP video camera out there for security purposes.
Cool. Zone that baby out.
May need to get a ditch witch and just put some cable down.
Well, I'm going to have to run some more water. So there's Cat 6 direct burial cables going in with it.
Okay.
Because there's just no way I'm going to get the throughput that I want.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I mean, for a device that's between $199 and $299, because they have several variants. There's like 3 variants of each. There's one version of both of the Stream 13-inch and 11-inch that have touch screens on them.
Are they like pastel colors or something?
Yeah, one's a blue. It's not really a pastel, but it's a bright blue. And one's magenta for, you know, the boys and girls. But it's a pretty nice machine. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not built like a really, really well-built laptop. There's a little flex in the case and all this. But, I mean, the screen is very legible for something that cheap. It would not be... I would have no problem buying one of these and sending it to school with a kid. And if it got stolen or taken, I wouldn't be heartbroken.
It's got full OS on it. I mean, that...
That was the big thing for me, is it came full OS. And you can't buy a full copy of Windows 8 for almost as much as the hardware.
Yeah.
And, it's not a subscription deal. It's, you just buy it and you go. I was impressed. So, lastly,
we get on this because Paul says he has to get going.
I have a meeting.
Meeting, schmeeting. It's Christmas. Everybody's out. And that is, we're going to talk a couple minutes about the Sony hack. I'm a little disappointed about the Sony hack. Not so much that. I'm of two minds of this. So it's. From the network security hacker cracker side of me, I look at it and I look at how brilliant the hack is. And it's not brilliant from the perspective that it took a lot of hacking skill to get into Sony Pictures
negligibly protected computer systems and things, but it was the social.
Oh, how they've exploited it.
Well, no, well, I mean, but
what do you know? Because I heard it was a stolen username password from an admin.
It was. And how they got that was they actually, the details aren't there, but it appears that Sony's physical physical security was negligent or negligible. There was nothing there. They didn't use cipher locks in the doors or keypads and key cards and things to get in.
It's Hollywood, man.
And, you know, people were just coming and going, and people were posing as employees, and it very well could be some employees were involved. They haven't determined that yet. But the social, that part of it, that social aspect to exploit the physical security to get into the network security, I think is phenomenal, because it's the one thing that everybody can't seem to get their head around when you're talking about network security.
The human factor is always your biggest threat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether intentional or unintentional, there is just no way around that. You cannot consistently set a person to do something that's beyond our ability. You know,
yep.
I mean, you desire them to be as secure as possible, but every one of us makes compromises every day in decisions we make.
Absolutely.
And so as an IT and more specifically as a security guy within IT, that's our biggest issue from day to day.
We all know that.
And even within ourselves, you know, those that have the keys to certain parts of the kingdom, we have to watch ourselves.
Absolutely.
The biggest threat's inside the walls. Always has been.
But I mean, you know, the fact that, and unfortunately the media has not picked up on this, you know, they hear, well, they stole 100 terabytes of Sony data. Well, how did they get to that? Nobody's telling the story up to that point. That's the story that's the part of the story that is the espionage. That is the taking the data and then throwing it out there and getting access to their systems. That's
the end of the game.
That's the end of the game. Yeah. That wasn't the smart part, because once they had access, you have access.
We want to know how they got there.
Yeah, and it's still the art of the con.
Yeah.
When we look at it that way.
I recall many, many, many years ago, during the beginning, when actually security looked at this more often, working at Wright Patterson Air Force Base, somebody sent an email out, and it was directed from one of our commanders.
Mm-hmm.
Sent an email out and goes, "Hey, we're doing an audit on everybody's username and password. Please respond with your username and password." And it looked very official. It was great. And you would not believe how many people, username and password. There you go. And
here's my clear text.
And so, you know, at that point, after we put the results together, the general who was in charge went back and he said, all of you have to go through a remedial security training, you know, before you can touch a keyboard again. And this is years ago. I mean, we were on Windows 95, 98 at that time. Not like those were secure systems. But, you know, they don't do the whole social engineering aspect of hacking, which is what gets you access 99.9999% of the time, doesn't occur anymore within not only would I say government space, but within corporate structure either, because they're worried about securing the inside of their network. And, you know,
that's why if you're serious about security, you are not connected to the internet.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you would have a
private network entirely. That is the best firewall in the world, is to not connect it, to not bridge it. But then you have to fight
abstinence.
You still have to fight your own people from bringing in their phone and plugging it into the network and somehow having a bridge activate.
Yep.
And, I mean, while that's not something you can consistently exploit, if someone has socially engineered it and figured out this is what you do on a consistent basis, the game is up.
Yep. Well, the big issue for them is that they didn't have the physical security systems in place that would have negated a lot of the social engineering capabilities. Because,
yeah, they were connected to the internet, which allowed the data to be transferred off easily. Mm-hmm. But the systems were relatively well protected from that perspective. Users and passwords, encryption, and that thing. But, you know, encryption only works if I always tell customers this because I get a lot of questions about data at rest security. And, you know, their mm-hmm. thing is, well, what if somebody pulls a hard drive and out of our RAID array and they walk off with it? And the first thing I go is, well, one, how long do you think it's going to take to rebuild all that data on a single disk that was in a RAID array where you only have this much of the data? How much usable data are you going to get off of it? And then I go, and the bigger question I have to ask is, what's your physical security policy that would allow somebody to get in there and be able to pull a disk out and get it out?
Well, I think we're coming to a point in computing where the OSs are going to be designed around security as a core principle, not just as, I mean, yeah, we kind of do it now, but we really don't have telemetry on a lot of things unless we add on top of the operating system. And I think it needs to be baked in more and more. You know, so if somebody is moving a file, that gets audited
yeah.
or logged. And yeah, you can turn these features on in enterprise and, you know, if you're an advanced user. But by default, most of the time it's off. And for IT groups to go in and turn it on and to maintain and be vigilant yeah. about it, it is a very labor-intensive task.
Absolutely. Right.
And it's costly. And without the help of it being baked in from the start, I don't think networks are going to get any more secure in the near future.
Not only do you have to, if you're capturing logs, you also have to analyze those logs, too.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
very intense.
Well, and that's the part that a lot of people don't do.
There's some good open-source things like Elk. Just look up Elk and logging. It's actually a combination of three open source products that allow you to do, it's like Elasticsearch and two other products. But basically it centralizes all of your logs and it allows you to do really more natural language searches through it. And it's a really slick system. If you've ever seen Splunk, it's a commercial product. Splunk's
natural language.
Well,
right?
Splunk is the commercial
version of it. Yeah.
Well, it's a completely separate product. Don't get me wrong.
I know.
But what's it called again?
Well, it's called, just look up Elk. It's
Elk?
Yeah, ELK. But that's your open source version on that.
So it's like an open source.
But still, this stuff needs to start being baked in, you know, especially with the enterprise, the server products, Windows and the Linuxes of the world need to, I don't know, there needs to be another abstraction layer, I guess, that is just about that. Other than Audit D.
Yeah.
Which does a good job. Don't get me wrong. I have to deal with it. But it needs to be better.
Yep.
Yeah. The other thing I'm disappointed with, too, though, is so the hack alone has cost, just on the outset,
cost Sony $117 million. There's probably another $200 or $300 million in liability lawsuits that they're going to have to pay out
mm-hmm. just because of the data that was leaked. You know, particularly from some of the stars. I mean, I hate to say it, just because it's them and not somebody else, but it is because it's them and not somebody else.
Well, not only the personally identifiable information, but all the HIPAA,
yeah.
all the Sarbanes. Well, they don't really do...
They don't have Sarbanes-Oxley requirements, but...
They might, depending on how they govern...
Well, the financials will have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it depends on which systems they got into and, you know...
But, you know, and then they're probably a couple $100 million... loss over canceling not showing the movie.
Yes. Which,
Now, the funny thing is, although I like Seth Rogen, and I
probably would not have gone and seen this movie. I would have waited till it came out on video right. or Netflix and watched it. But now I want to see it just because they didn't.
Yeah. It probably
has more demand than it would have had.
I would agree. You know, if they would put it in theaters, I would go see it. You know, whether it's my cup of tea or not, you know, if another government is messing with, you know, businesses in my country, this is a nice way to disobey them and say, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It just, it's just kind of ridiculous. Now,
the funny thing is, you know, obviously the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and I'm assuming the CIA and some of our intelligence agencies know a lot more about what's gone on and know exactly who did this. And we won't ever know the extent of what the repayment was, but it will be repaid. It usually is.
Well, they're saying the problem, the problems with North Korea is what more can you do to them?
Yeah, I mean,
really,
they're wanting to be a big kid at the table, but the problem is they're barely even a kid, know. But the problem is the kid has access to nuclear, potentially nuclear weapons, and you know a major population center is just, you know, 30, 40 miles south of their border, so they can easily lob one across the border. That's what keeps us at bay, I believe. But not that we want a war. We certainly don't. But, you know, there's not a whole lot of rationality behind this situation on that side of the fence, I believe.
No.
It's more about how they maintain their power within their own borders. And, you know, okay, they make a good show, but they're only hurting their own people, which is
I don't think they have
horrible thing.
I don't think the government there has a cares. I mean, I think they look at their people as a largely
expendable resource.
Slave resource. You know, you will do X for us in that elite few.
Aren't they saying that threats to the theaters are they're not connected? They're not the same people, right?
I
think that might have just been
who knows, but. Yeah, who knows? I'm not really terribly concerned. I wasn't terribly concerned when that threat came out.
If you're not going to put it in the theaters, I would burn it directly to DVD and Blu-ray now and put it in every Walmart in the world. I'm serious.
Well, I don't think you even have to do that. I think
give it free for pay-per-view or for
put it on Netflix streaming.
Was it Romney?
Netflix
Romney tweeted the other day, you know, put it out for free, and if you want, make it a $5 donation for Ebola research in Africa. And I'm like, hey, that is a cool idea.
Absolutely.
And that would get some of their clout back. But, yeah, I think they certainly wimped out. Now, they have taken a large hit lately, so I'll grant them a little bit there, but I think they wimped out.
All the theaters came together, and they were the ones that voted not to. So they wouldn't show it because.
But look at it from the National Association of Theater Owners' position. They have, within the last couple of years, suffered a mass murder at a Batman premiere.
Right. Yeah,
you know, they have enough bad press to deal with.
And guess what's happening in the next 3 weeks? Some of their biggest audiences of the year.
I think the big issue was is they knew that they're going to make a bulk of their money on The Hobbit, so.
Well, there's a lot of premieres coming out.
Well, you know, but look at the
day. They don't want to scare people off.
Yeah. Look at the day the interview was due to be released. It was due to be released on Christmas. And you know what that says to me? They had a contender. You know, it's not The Hobbit.
But
there's a lot of folks that aren't, you know, sci-fi fantasy nerds that are like, I don't want to go see that. I want to go laugh. And that would have been the one they would have gone and seen.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of Jewish families this year who'll be upset because they won't be able to see that movie.
Hey, I know a lot of other folks that are of different faiths that, you know, that's the thing.
We go to a movie on Thanksgiving every year. That's our tradition.
So,
no, I have a lot of friends, and sometimes we do too, but where we celebrate Christmas is kind of far away from the movie theater, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's not my family's tradition, but I know I have friends that it's like as soon as their kids were old enough and they wanted to see something, that's what they would do.
The holidays in general is when a lot of people see movies, and they release a lot of movies.
Yeah.
So I feel, feel bad for Rogan and Franco because, this probably would have done pretty okay at the box office, and certainly after post sales and.
Well, I mean, Sony's not releasing it now. It doesn't mean they might not release it.
Right.
Which is why they're not doing anything with it.
Yeah.
That's why they're holding on.
That's right. Yeah.
I did like the Alamo Drafthouse out of Austin. Their response was initially to show Team America World Police, but then Paramount pulled it from them, so they couldn't show that either.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a pretty good episode for our centennial.
Woo.
It's too bad Adam wasn't here.
And we couldn't have pulled in some of the other Gizmo Sapiens across the nation as they're spread out. But we might try that again. I guess our next step is to shoot for 125 episodes.
Okay.
It's another milestone.
Yeah.
So that'll be in 10 years.
That's not true. It only took us, what? Lord, how long am I doing this? I don't know. Since 2007, 2008.
So seven years.
7 years. Yeah, in 7 years we'll hit show 200. Well, I'll be old men by then. Most of us.
No comment.
So, with that said, we want to hear from you. Please send us your audio, video, text comments to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we will see you on the digital flip side.
To Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.